Thanks, Tony. This is a hard talk to give because it's something like trying to give encapsulate all of physics in 1 hour, because this is a field of evolutionary psychology. So what we're going to do is give some of the basic general logic and then just some demonstrations. And the demonstrations are not themselves meant to be convincing, because any experiment only rules out one of, you know, a very large number of hypotheses. And so there's a very large pyramid of unseen experiments, but these are more just to give you a flavor of the kind of experimental evidence that goes into making inferences about the structure of the human mind. I guess one of the basic, really basic hypotheses, which Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, calls the astonishing hypothesis, is that the mind is the activity of the brain now, and not ectoplasmic goo or whatever, is that the brain is in fact the physical basis of what we think and what we feel and so on. And to most people of a natural science persuasion, this is not an astonishing hypothesis, but just a routine starting point. But actually, people don't take it as seriously as they might. The next kind of step beyond the fact that the mind is a physical system that we've studied in a physical way is that it's something more than just a chance agglomeration of properties like a heap of rocks or any other physical system. It's also a computational system. That is, it has a highly non-random organization. And this highly non-random organization is there because it computes certain things. It processes information. And then the next principle, the starting point, is that in fact this computational structure and this, the physical embodiment that creates a computational structure, didn't happen by chance, but in fact these computational systems were built in as functions. Okay, and the next step is that those functions arose through the evolutionary process, and the non-random component of the evolutionary process is natural selection. And so that the brain was built because of the computations it carries out, because the computational structures solve problems for our ancestors in the environment in which we evolved. Okay, and this is what it is to take a sort of a relentlessly natural science approach. Okay. She's actually giving this talk. So then the question is, what's all the big mystery? I mean, we're not trying to make inferences about, a pulsar or something we can't visit. We're in fact surrounded by these organic robots, human beings, and we ourselves are such a thing. And so what's all the mystery about? And the basic mystery is that we're extremely complex systems. Okay, we have trillions of cells organized in really complicated ways. So how can you find perspectives that can get some of the sort of traction or the satisfaction of coherent theories that will explain something about all this amazing stuff that human beings generate and that human beings embody and so on? And so the next step is that by using some of these other insights, the mind is a physical system, that the brain is a computational system, that the functions arose from natural selection, is that you can use those insights to reverse engineer human beings. We have working robots all around us, and we can do experiments on those robots. There's so many different ways you could approach it, and there's libraries full of stuff. But the question is, can you come up with meaningful theories? Okay. And the notion is that there's subcomponents in the brain, subcomponents in the mind, and that you can develop theories of those subcomponents by doing something which might be analogous to certain types of physics experiments. That is, in this sense, you send in logic probes. You have a circuit board, you send a logic probe in, some sort of structured piece of data, and you get a structured piece of data out, which is different, and you make inferences about the structure of the circuit. And however, there's so many different possible experiments you could do that you would never get around to doing the right ones unless you had some preliminary theories about what those circuits were likely to accomplish. And that comes from natural selection. That's from knowing our evolutionary history, knowing what hunter-gatherer life was. That if you have a sort of a notion that we arose in a physical way rather than by a divine intervention or something else, then you know that the non-random movement towards organization of the brain over evolutionary time happened because some random variants in these circuits solve problems better and some solve problems worse. So if you have a theory of the problems, okay, then you have some information about the likely structure of those circuits. And that then with that plus experimentation, you can go in and you can start to map, you know, where the system is really only in its infancy, but you can start to map with great success the computational structure of some of these subcomponents of the human mind. And so the concept of reverse engineering here is very important, that this is a science that's not exactly like physics in the sense that you have a few general overarching principles. It's much more like engineering, in which you have a theory of how it is that this automobile or, you know, works. That is, you have a system, subcomponents are designed to accomplish certain goals, they work together, the system is highly heterogeneous, and but each subsystem is intelligible by concepts of function.
And the higher level principles are at the evolutionary level.
Right, there are higher level principles. Theories of selection pressures are one of the big things that made this whole approach to humans possible was that evolutionary biology went through a revolution about 20 years ago, 20 to 30 years ago, and is still ongoing now, which took a bunch of very fuzzy, vague theories and put them in a rigorous mathematical way and provided specific sub-theories of different types of adaptive problems that organisms face. And that's one of the key changes that's been going on here. Okay, so when we started out actually in this field, there was a very unsatisfying theory of what the human mind was like, and that was this theory. So we thought, you know, actually I was convinced I was going to go into be an astrophysicist, but then looking at when I was an undergraduate, it seemed to me that the physical sciences knew a lot. Okay, and then I also took some psychology courses, and this was the model I was presented. It seemed to me that that there was room for advancement there. Okay, and that was very appealing. That the notion you could go in and you could, you know, start to do something interesting about such an interesting topic. And of course, now we're advancing to the future. Okay, and this is the model that we would like to present you with. This is from a book on phrenology. And this is really the more modern view that we've advanced to from the last model I want to show you. Now, what's different is, of course, that the circuit, the subcomponents are no longer things like reverence or patriotism or chastity and so on. But there's a whole different theory of the components there. Okay, but. And just one other point I want to make before we start to get very serious, and this comes from William James. And one thing is, evolutionary psychology might not be correct, but it has better writers. Okay, and William James, the earliest psychologists were evolutionary psychologists before there was sort of the behaviorist interregnum. Okay, and the thing which is really difficult is that because we are what we are studying, okay, and the mind automates certain types of inferences. Most of what's interesting about human beings is so intuitive thus we don't even realize it's there. Like fish are going to be the last people to discover water. Okay. And that's why another reason why a biological approach has been so important is because there's all these different robots out there, all these different architectures which do really different things, that, you know, squid do really different things than I do most of the time. And therefore you automate and therefore it becomes invisible. You don't have to have part of your consciousness. Most of the complex inferences and automatic processing that the human mind does. Okay, but by taking a comparative perspective, you can get rid of this blindness to our own instincts, and you can so that in my own field, anthropology, most anthropologists would say human beings have no instinct. Okay, but in fact, as soon as you look at an ant or a squid or a manta ray or something, as soon as you find out that there's a huge amount of content, organization. You go open up Gray's Anatomy, there's a universal human design, there's human universal neural design, and that encodes a whole bunch of information processing algorithms which are universal to our species but different from other species. Okay, so that the whole point of evolutionary psychology is to debauch your mind, as William James put it, that it takes a mind debauched by learning to carry out the process of making the natural seem strange, so far as to ask for the why of any instinctive human act. To the metaphysician alone can such questions occur as, why do we smile when pleased and not scowl? Why are we unable to talk to a crowd as we talk to a single friend? Why does a particular maiden turn our wits so upside down? Okay. The common man can only say, of course we smile, of course our heart palpitates at the sight of the crowd. Of course we love the maiden, that beautiful soul clad in that perfect form, so palpably and flagrantly made for all eternity to be loved. Okay. See, so evolutionary psychology, at least the writing of it, is a little bit different than physics. Okay. And so probably does each animal feel about the particular things it tends to do in the presence of particular objects. To the lion is the lioness which is made to be loved, to the bear the she-bear, to the broody hen. The notion would probably seem monstrous that there should be a creature in the world to whom a nest full of eggs is not the utterly fascinating and precious and never to be too much sat upon thing, which object which it is to her. Okay. And so the whole point is, in fact, to bring into visibility a lot of this highly organized neural circuitry as expressed in that then has outputs as behavioral patterns, and see if we can reverse engineer it and also understand its functional organization. Okay. And I'll skip that. And I'll skip that. And how many minutes? 5, 6, okay. I was getting dire threats for her if I ran too long. Okay. Right. Okay. So it takes specific evolutionary theories of adaptive problems which our ancestors solved, okay? And those can be posed or reformulated as computational problems or information processing problems. And until you have those theories, you won't think to test for the presence of circuits in the brain that might embody these kinds of things. So as Einstein said, it's the theory which decides what we can observe. People do millions of experiments, but they're not necessarily designed to capture in an organized way this reverse engineering process, okay? And that the meta theory, of course, is that in evolution, because that's how you get all these different species-specific architectures with their highly improbable or functional organizations, okay? And so an evolutionary approach allows you to recognize what natural consciousness exist, that is, these subcomponents which compute various kinds of outcomes. And another big change is that the social sciences have been built up for a century on the notion that the mind is a blank slate. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in a moment, but this is another large change in that's coming about from this new approach, which is that there's more and more evidence that if you think of the mind as a computational system, that's much more like, instead of a single general purpose computer, it's much more like a network of highly dedicated, specialized computational units, each of which is dedicated to computing some specific sub-problem, okay? And that's why the sort of the progress of this kind of science is going to be slow, it's going to be accretional. That is, you'll develop a theory of this subcomponent and a theory of that subcomponent, and out of maybe thousands of those subcomponents, we have maybe mapped half a dozen. So no big claims here about we understand everything or we can make public policy pronouncements. Nobody knows anything remotely like that. We now have a key that can unlock how to go about doing this, okay? Anyway, so instead of a blank slate, the notion that the human mind embodies a lot of sophisticated procedural knowledge or what Plato would have called innate ideas, okay? And that natural selection and a model of human hunter-gatherer life, put those together and you develop theories of the designs of these independent competences. So you can get, when we're not reading William James to each other, you can actually make fairly sophisticated principle models of adaptive problems, formal computational models. And then you develop hypotheses about the problem-solving structure of the computation, what has to happen for those adaptive problems to be solved, okay? And the notion is that the structure of the environment selects for computational structures that fit in very precise and detailed ways with the adaptive problem so that together it can cause a solution, okay? And you could develop, measures of non-random coordination, so you can develop hypothesis testing. Okay. And you go from, so you go from the theory of the adaptive problem to a theory of the cognitive program that solves the adaptive problem. And once you've tested and seen that you have some sort of specific theory or a good computational model of that, then you can look for the neurophysiological basis, because all these things are, of course, embodied in neural tissue, and that has, that physical basis might be localized, might not be, it might be distributed around the brain, but you can start to at least then go to the next step. Okay. So if you're studying natural competences, there's four things that really have come out. One is that instead of these information processing problems being very simple, requiring only simple computation, it turns out the problems are extremely difficult problems to solve. That they are, for example, people studying vision talk about scene reconstruction is an ill-posed problem. That is, there isn't a unique solution to taking information on the retina and coming up with a three-dimensional model of what it is that's been seen. There's an infinite number of possible solutions. The next sort of principle that comes, or realization that comes out of this kind of study is that there's well-engineered solutions, problem-solving machinery, the evolved solution to these complex, specific adaptive problems. And there's been some controversy about this, but lots of people say adaptations are not very good. They're certainly not optimal. Nobody would claim they're optimal, but they're highly non-randomly well-engineered, okay? And the reason why I actually don't think there's a very serious controversy is because whenever you test an organism on an adaptive problem which it's had been part of its evolutionary history to solve, the solutions are much better than what human engineers have been able to come up with. Okay, so if you look at human vision versus, you know, hundreds of researchers have been working with budgets of tens of millions of dollars for 30 years, and artificial vision is just nothing like real vision. Okay, so that it seems to me that if somebody wants to argue that an adaptation is bad, they ought to be able to produce something that looks better, okay, rather than just a general vague claim. Okay, and people can't really do that. Okay, so we have well-engineered problem-solving machinery as the evolved solution, okay? The next sort of theme that comes out of this is to get this well-engineered fit is you get specialization, okay? Subparts of the brain are really specialized to the particular nature of a problem, and that the reason why you get so much traction or so much problem-solving power is that you can embody, because the world has certain stable properties, you can work into the problem-solving algorithms a lot of information about the likely solution, okay? And in some philosophical sense, you might call this innate knowledge. So we're not talking about, and there's lots of things which are culturally constructed and differ, individually idiosyncratic things you taught yourself that nobody else may know. Okay, we're not talking about any of that, okay? What we're talking about... Right, could people hear, or are you... What she's saying is, I don't think your mic is on or something. Anyway.
Yeah, can people in the back?
Okay. What she's saying is that what we're talking about in terms of when I use the phrase natural competence or a phrase like that, an adaptive specialization, we're not talking about things like playing chess, which we didn't evolve to do, or doing physics, or science, or any of those kinds of culturally particular activities. We're talking about things which reliably develop in all ordinary humans as part of brain development in ordinary environments. And so these are what you might call reasoning instincts. That is, they're complexly specialized for solving an adaptive problem. They reliably develop in all ordinary human beings. Doing calculus does not reliably develop in all ordinary human beings. Okay? It develops without any conscious effort. Okay? It develops without formal instruction. And people tend to apply these things without any awareness of their underlying logic. They don't know where it comes from. They don't even are aware that there's anything. You just open your eyes and you see. You're not aware of, in fact, the incredible complexity of the exquisite information processing steps, which goes from light hitting your retina to your having a three-dimensional representation of huge subtlety about the environment around you. Okay? You're not even aware, nobody was even aware that vision was a very complicated problem. So in AI, the story is that Marvin Minsky assigned it to a graduate, artificial vision assigned it to a graduate student for as a summer project, okay? And that was a while ago, and it's not very far, okay? And it's distinct from more general abilities to process information or behave intelligently, okay?
Just to give you a brief example that's not from our own work of what one might think of as a reasoning instinct. There's a proposal that autism is a selective impairment of an ability to infer mental states of others, that people with autism have problems with a specialized machine that allows you to use things like eye direction to infer mental states like wanting, believing, and so forth. And so this is from the work of Simon Baron Cohen, just to give you a simple example. This is called the Charlie task. There's this little face, and I don't draw very well, excuse me, but four candies surrounding the face. Now, if you ask any three-year-old which candy, this is supposed to be a neutral expression, sorry, which candy does Charlie want, any normal three-year-old will say this one, i.e. point to the one that Charlie is looking at. If you ask a person with autism who has an otherwise normal IQ, which candy Charlie wants, the person with autism is random. Now, you might say to yourself, well, maybe the person with autism just can't compute to the direction of eye gaze. But if you ask the person which candy is Charlie looking at, people with autism will point to the one that Charlie's looking at. This is very interesting because they can compute eye direction, but they don't use that piece of information to make an inference about a mental state of wanting. That's an example of what John was talking about of instinct blindness, that this is something we do so automatically. We use eye direction to infer mental states and so forth. We don't even realize that there's something there to be explained. In fact, sometimes when there's an impairment of some sort, it's easier to see that there was something that required explanation. When a little piece of mental machinery is broken, you can see it better sometimes, although that's not the only way that you can approach these questions. Okay, so let's go back to the blank slate thing and so forth for a moment. So you can ask then, what kind of circuits would you expect natural selection to have created? And there's basically two views. One is the one that John was talking about, the one from William James, the notion that the mind is full of specialized mechanisms. And the second is the traditional view that was made popular before Darwin by the British empiricists. And it's the antithesis of the view propounded by William James. And this is the view that the mind is basically a blank slate and that experience is the hand that writes on the slate. So, for example, you see this in No Man's Knowledge Here Can Go Beyond His Experience, or here from David Hume, all the materials of our thinking are derived either from our outward or inward sentiment. And then he even goes so far as to say what the laws of thought are. There appear to be only three principal connections among ideas, namely a resemblance, contiguity in time or space, and cause or effect. Now, since the days of the British empiricists, our technology has gotten better, and our technological metaphors that are frequently used in psychology have followed suit. So nowadays, instead of viewing the mind as a blank slate, it's typically viewed as a computer, but a computer governed by general-purpose reasoning circuits. Circuits that do little more than compute Humean type of relations like similarity, contiguity, and cause and effect. And perhaps a few logic circuits as well. But although the technological metaphor has changed a bit, the central idea of the British empiricists has really remained, and that is that all the particulars of what we think and feel derive externally from the world of experience and especially from the social world. This is the notion that the mind has no inherent content. So, for example, a lot of cognitive psychologists have thought that we have very few reasoning circuits and that these embody the laws of formal logic, or in this case, actually, the propositional calculus. In other words, they thought that the laws of thought were the laws of logic and that the mind would contain reasoning circuits that performed inferences like modus ponens and modus tollens. And just in case you don't remember this from your logic courses, these are content-independent inference rules. If P, you're told that if P then Q is true, you're told that P is true. From this, you can conclude that Q is true. Modus tollens is you're told that if P then Q is true, then you're told that Q is not true. Not Q simply means Q is not true. From this, you can validly infer that P is not true, that P is false. Now, to put some content into it, to give an example, let me use the master of deductive reasoning, Sherlock Holmes. In Silver Blaze, Holmes is trying to find a missing horse. And he knows that a dog was in the stable with the horse when someone came into the stable to steal the horse. And he also knows that the following rule is true, is that if a stranger enters the stable, then the dog barks. So that's an if P then Q statement. Now, with modus ponens, you would be able to, if somebody then told you a stranger entered the stable, you would be able to infer that the dog barked. That would be an example of modus ponens. But Holmes solved the case using modus tollens. Using modus tollens. The inspector asks Holmes whether he wants to draw his attention to anything in particular. And Holmes says, yes, to the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. And the inspector says, but the dog did nothing in the nighttime. And Holmes says, that was a curious incident. So he basically was making the inference, if a stranger enters the stable, then the dog barks. But the dog did not bark, therefore a stranger did not enter the stable. Now, he knew somebody entered the stable, so he knew that it had to be somebody that was familiar to the dog, and that let him narrow his hypotheses and solve the case. A lot of people are pretty good at making deductions using modus ponens. They're not so hot at using modus tollens, actually. But I want you to note before...
Based on experiments.
Based on reasoning experiments.
If you give people problems of that kind, they...
You give them, you can, for example, give them this and say, what can you infer from that, and see whether, they infer this more often. Any of you, including physicists, including philosophers
of logic. Logicians.
Well, actually, not this, but I'll show you something that logicians often get wrong.
So this is an important distinction, because there's the things that people do intuitively and then things they do through special instruction. And your different parts of your brain may be doing things that come to different conclusions. And so, in fact, if you take physicists, people have done this, and you ask them dynamical questions, you ask the physicists to sit on their hands, and they can't use pencil and paper and so on, they will give incorrect answers, which will be the same incorrect answers that that non-physically trained people, everybody else does. Right? From which we conclude physicists are humans.
So what I want you to notice about... about the propositional calculus is the notion that P and Q can stand for anything. This is what I mean by being content independent. It doesn't matter what the subject matter is. P and Q can stand for anything. All right. Now, as you all know, Karl Popper argued that science progresses when people put forth hypotheses and then try to falsify them. And after reading Popper, a British psychologist named Peter Wason became interested in the idea that people might be intuitive scientists, that everyday learning might be a kind of Popperian hypothesis testing. If that were true, then people would be very good at looking for violations of hypotheses, especially violations of hypotheses cast as if-then rules like this. Now, to see if this was the case, he developed what he thought of as a test of logical reasoning that became known as the Wason selection test. And I'm going to give you an example. This is one of the ones that logicians get wrong at first, too. I mean, they agree what the answer is after you discuss it with them. All right. Part of your new clerical job at the local high school is to make sure that student documents have been processed correctly. Your job is to make sure that the documents conform to the following alphanumeric rule. If a person has a D rating, then his documents must be marked code 3. You suspect the secretary you replaced did not categorize the student's documents correctly. The cards below have information about the documents of 4 people who are enrolled at this high school. Each card represents 1 person. One side of a card tells a person's letter rating, and the other side of the card tells that person's number code. Indicate only those card or cards you definitely need to turn over to see if the documents of any of these people violate this rule. Well, I won't put you on the spot, but you probably are already knowing what the answer is, but you need to turn over this card, right? The only thing that can violate this rule is a combination of a D with something other than 3, right? So you need to turn over the D card, right? You don't need to turn over the F card, because this doesn't say what you do if there's an, and maybe things with F have to be code 3 too, you just don't know. You actually don't need to turn over the 3 card. Many people think you do, but you don't. And you do need to turn over the 7 card, right? Because if there's a D on the other side of this, then that would violate the rule. You don't need to turn over the 3 card because, for the same reason, you don't need to turn over the F card, right? In fact, for a rule of the general form if P then Q, the general answer is that you need to turn over the P card and the not Q card, because only the combination of P with not Q will violate that rule. All right. That's not what people do. When you give them this task, what they usually do is they either turn over P alone or P and Q. Very few people turn over P and not Q and not the other 2 cards. Right? In fact, it's particularly not what they particularly do is they don't realize you need not Q. Right? So usually only. Normally, only about 4 to 10% of people realize that you pick P and not Q and no other card. Sometimes it might go up to 25%. But even with 25%, if you give this to undergraduates at Stanford or Harvard who have really high SAT scores, 25% of them might get this right. This, I claim, does not make you a poster child for Popperian hypothesis testing. Only 25% correct on this. Now, you might be thinking, oh, well, this is abstract, it's got letters, and, well, actually, you're physicists, you might not be thinking that. But people have thought that, and so obviously the first thing that they did was they gave it more familiar content, and they tested people on rules, like if a person goes to Boston and that person takes the subway, they thought maybe it's just easier to think about more concrete things, but people do badly on this, too. So familiarity, per se, cannot explain this bad performance on this task. All right? Now, okay. Now, results like this suggested to people that the mind doesn't seem to have reasoning circuits that are specialized for logical reasoning. Yeah?
Now, Pinker actually phrased this problem in terms of bouncer at a bar.
I'm getting to that.
Obvious, right?
I'm getting to that.
Yeah, you're going to get
Oh, I'm going to get to that. Boy, am I going to get to that. I'm going to, yes. Yes. We may have some modus ponens circuits. It's not clear whether we have modus tollens ones, but we certainly, even if we do, we don't seem to mobilize them for hypothesis testing and for looking for violations of hypotheses. Now, the human mind, you know, is clearly a computer of some sort in the sense that it processes information. I mean, that's trivial. I mean, why have a brain, right? To make your behavior sensitively contingent on information from your environment. But if its circuits are not content-independent, general-purpose ones embodying inferences like those of formal logic, then what kind of circuits do we have and what are their functions? So this is what I mean when I was showing you modus tollens and modus ponens. There were proposals that we have programs in our heads that embody those little logic circuits, for example. That's what I mean by a content-independent mental function or program. Now,
that anything can stand for P, anything can stand
right,
for Q.
Exactly.
That's the level at which things are operated on.
So instead of thinking about the mind as a blank slate or a general purpose computer, let me substitute a different technological metaphor. That is, the mind is a Swiss Army knife. Now, if you think about a Swiss Army knife, it's got all these specialized devices on it. It's got the scissors, it's got a bottle opener, it's got a, you know, the Phillips screwdriver, all the toothpick, all these different things. Each one is well designed for solving a different problem, and you bundle them all together, and you've got a really useful, flexible mechanism. And I want to propose that the mind is similarly. You have a lot of special purpose well-designed devices. You bundle them together, you've got a really smart organism. And then you want to ask, well, what things do we have in our own mental Swiss Army knives? What kind of circuits do we have? Well, you know, obviously for natural selection to create a complex device, it needs enough time to act. And the Industrial Revolution and even the Agricultural Revolution, which is only, you know, 10,000 years old, these are eye blinks in evolutionary time. The hominid line spent well over 99% of its evolutionary history engaged in hunting and gathering, so that if the brain contains specialized reasoning circuits, they should be designed to solve the day-to-day problems of Pleistocene hunter-gatherers. So you might think that there might be ones for reasoning about mates, for about foraging, about disease avoidance, about inbreeding avoidance, about predators, about aggression, about a whole array of important adaptive problems. And John and I have spent a lot of our time studying circuits that it seems to be specialized for reasoning about, number of different domains, but the one I'm going to talk about today is circuits that seem to be specialized for reasoning about social exchange or cooperation for mutual benefit. Now, social exchange derives from an economist concept of trade. It's social exchange behavior is both universal and it's highly elaborated across cultures, presenting itself in many forms like reciprocal gift giving, food sharing, market pricing, and so on. It doesn't appear to be a recent invention, like writing rice cultivation or, you know, computer programming. There's no evidence of there being a single point of origin and then it having spread by contact, no evidence of it being absent from any culture. Instead, it seems to be a very ancient, pervasive aspect of human social life. Paleoanthropological evidence suggests that social exchange extends back at least 2 million years, and the fact that it exists in some of our primate cousins suggests that it may be even more ancient than that. So in other words, situations involving social exchange have constituted a long-enduring selection pressure on the hominid line. Now, in evolutionary biology, researchers such as Robert Shrivers, W.D. Hamilton, and Axelrod have explored constraints on the evolution of social exchange using game theory and modeling it as a repeated prisoner's dilemma situation. Some of you may be familiar with some of these things, like in the evolution of cooperation and so forth. And one of the things, these analyses have turned up a lot of interesting things about social exchange. Sometimes it's called, in this literature, reciprocal altruism, cooperation, all the same thing in this case. One of the interesting constraints is that you can't, for the purpose of the research I'm going to be talking about, is that you can't get social exchange to evolve in a species unless individuals have some means of detecting cheaters, individuals who cheat, individuals who have accepted benefits without reciprocating the favor. And in fact, game theoretic strategies such as tit for tat, if you're familiar with this literature, they're successful precisely because they reward individuals who cooperate and they punish individuals who cheat. And so we use these theories from evolutionary biology to develop a task analysis of social exchange to define what are the different subcomponent problems that an information processing system that's capable of engaging this kind of behavior would have to be able to solve to engage in social exchange, which you don't see in all species, just in some species. So using these analyses, let's define for the moment a social contract in a particular way, as a situation in which an individual is obligated to satisfy a requirement of some kind, usually at some cost to him or herself, in order to be entitled to receive a benefit from another individual or group. The requirement is imposed because its satisfaction creates a situation that benefits the party that imposed it. So if I say to you, if you give me a watch, I'll give you $10, I'm offering to give you a benefit that is $10 in exchange for something that I consider to be an even greater benefit to me, your watch. But if I wanted the $10 more than your watch, I wouldn't say it in the first place, right? Now, you'll only agree to my offer if you would prefer having $10 to keeping your watch. Now, a well-formed social contract expresses an intercontingent situation of mutual benefit. To receive a benefit, an individual or group is required to provide a benefit. Usually, but not always, one incurs a cost by satisfying the requirement, but that cost is outweighed by the benefit that one receives in return. So social exchange is basically an I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine principle. Now cheating, you could think of as a violation of a social contract. A cheater is an individual who illicitly benefits him or herself by taking a benefit without having satisfied the requirement the other party has made, the contract made that provision of that benefit contingent on. So what counts as cheating depends on your perspective. I would have cheated you if I took your watch but I did not give you the $10. You would have cheated me if you took my $10 but did not give me the watch. Now, natural selection can design circuits that cause us to deliver benefits to people who are unrelated to us, provided that there's a sufficient probability that the favor will be reciprocated. On the other hand, if I had circuits that caused me to constantly deliver benefits to you, regardless of whether you ever reciprocated the favor, then you might expect circuits causing me to behave in this way would eventually be selected out. Any design that results in my consistently being cheated, not on occasion, but consistently being cheated, would be selected out. So for this reason, we can't have circuits that make us want to deliver benefits to others unless we also have circuits that are good at detecting the possibility of cheating. Now, strangely enough, this brings us back to the waste and selection task. What we wanted to do was, we were interested in the question, do people have cognitive adaptations that are specialized for reasoning about social contracts? Cognitive adaptations, I mean specialized mental mechanisms, part of the evolved architecture of the mind. And in particular, we're interested in whether people have inference procedures that are specialized for cheater detection. And we approached this question by studying human reasoning. And there was a large literature that already existed that showed that people are not very good at detecting violations of conditional rules, even when they deal with familiar, I've underlined that even when they deal with familiar content drawn from everyday life, because nobody can ever believe it, but yes, even when it's familiar. And that's what I was showing you with the waste and selection task. Now, to show that people who ordinarily cannot detect violations of conditional rules can do so when that violation represents cheating on a social contract would constitute preliminary evidence that people have reasoning procedures that are specially designed for detecting cheaters in situations of social exchange. Well, one thing that seemed to make that plausible was the existence of this drinking age problem that Tony was mentioning. Now, even if the other problem was clear to you, see if my guess is that the answer will pop out to you in this case. In its crackdown against drunk drivers, Massachusetts law enforcement officials are revoking liquor licenses left and right. You're a bouncer in a Boston bar, and you'll lose your job unless you enforce the following law. If a person's drinking beer, then he must be over 20 years old. The cards below have information about four people sitting at a table in your bar. Each card represents one person. One side of a card tells what a person's drinking, and the other side of the card tells that person's age. Indicate only those cards you definitely need to turn over to see if any of these people are breaking this law. Right? I mean, yeah, these two, right? You know, obviously these people can't, even if they wanted to, they can't be breaking this law. Everybody knows that. Now, you take the same people where 4-10% of them got it right before, 75% of them get this one right. Right? But this too has the form if P then Q. And now all of a sudden, 75% of the people, they had no courses in logic or anything in between, right? They pick P and not Q. Okay, well, so that's nice, and that's slightly encouraging, but still, and also the fact that other familiar problems don't elicit effects like that, but you still want to say, is it just familiarity or whatever? In fact, what you want to do more specifically is you want to ask, and when we developed this task analysis, we thought there were a lot of different design features that circuits specialized for social exchange should have. These are just a few of them. They should be good at detecting cheaters. Familiarity shouldn't be relevant because you want to understand every social exchange you come to, not just the last one you were in, right? You're the new ones. It should involve an adaptive logic, not formal logic, that doesn't correspond necessarily to formal logic. Cost and benefits should be relevant to how you represent the situation, and it should be cheating and not innocent mistakes. Well, I'll show you what that means.
By formal logic, we mean the propositional calculus.
They'll see what that means when I show them the
By adaptive problem. Logic, we don't mean it's not formal. It has a very precise formal structure. It just is one that's derived
It's not content independent.
Natural selection rather
right,
than...
Okay, so the next thing we did was we created problems that we thought would be unfamiliar to your typical sophomore in a psychology experiment. What we did was we took rules like, if a man eats cassava roots, then he must have a tattoo on his face. We figured nobody in our experiments has ever heard this rule before because we just made it up and it's just ridiculous. And we put it into two different contexts. One context made it a social exchange rule. The other context made it a descriptive rule. It gave a reasonable gloss and so forth. So the social exchange version said it was set in a fictitious culture. And it said, okay, in this fictitious culture, it didn't say in this fictitious culture, it said among the Kalawami, a Polynesian group in Mako Island, and went on from there. And it said, these people, cassava root, they think of it as an aphrodisiac, and everybody really wants cassava root. Nobody really likes mola nuts. They're nasty and bitter. Nobody likes mola nuts very much. Having a tattoo on your face means that you're married. Not having a tattoo means you're unmarried. The people on this island, they're concerned about sexual mores, and so the elders have made a rule, if a man eats cassava root, then he must have a tattoo on his face. And then you're asked to look for individuals who violated this rule, okay? Now, individuals who violated this rule are individuals who have illicitly taken the benefit to eating a cassava root but don't have a tattoo. That's probably popped out to you, kind of like the drinking age problem did. The control problem gave familiar content. It said same sort of thing about the island, but it said cassava root and mola nuts are both staple foods on this island. Having a tattoo on your face means that you're married. Not having a tattoo means you're not married. The cassava tends to grow on one side of the island and the mola nuts on the other side of the island. And you hear people saying, if a man eats cassava, then he must have a tattoo on his face. And you're wondering if this expresses the fact that that you know that married men live on the same side of the island with the cassava and unmarried men with a mola nuts are. You're wondering if this rule merely expresses the fact that men are eating the foods that are most available to them, right? So you've made this rule intelligible, right? And then you ask people to look for violations of the rule, right? So you've made it intelligible, but it's not a social crime. There's no benefit that in order to get the benefit you have to meet a requirement for. Okay, so what? But it's got the same rule. If a man eats cassava root, then he must have a tattoo on his face. Okay, here's some results of this kind of problem. This is the descriptive rule, and these are the social contract rules. Different ones. As you're seeing, people are as good as the social contract one with this cassava root thing. They're as good as with the drinking age problem. This actually even surprised us, because we thought, well, you know, drinking age problem, people, you know, everyday life, they know the drinking age problem. But that actually doesn't even give you an edge. You're just as good at looking for people who have no tattoos on their face but are eating cassava root. You're getting 75% correct, 71% correct in this area with the social exchange problems. Okay, well, that's nice. So you can use these totally ridiculous problems that have nothing to do with familiar content from everyday life, and you get the same thing happening, people choosing P and not Q. But you can say, well, but P and not Q is a logically correct response. Maybe for some reason, now I can't think of a good reason for this hypothesis, but you could say, maybe for some reason social contract content is facilitating logical reasoning. Okay, well then, you can test this easily. All right, now the things we've been looking at are things that have the general form, if you take the benefit, then you pay the cost, or if you take the benefit, then you meet the requirement. And when you're looking for a cheater, you're always looking for somebody who's accepted the benefit and not paid the cost, right? Person who's paid the cost and not accepted the benefit, they may be an altruist, or they may be a fool, but they haven't cheated you, right? That's why also this isn't a biconditional. Oh, by the way, even on the original thing, people don't reason about them as biconditionals, in case you were wondering. Anyway. All right. Now, if you put the rule in this form, the correct cheater detection answer, benefit accepted, cost not paid, happens to correspond to the logically correct answer of P and not Q. But you could phrase the rule differently. You could say if you pay the cost, then you take the benefit. So instead of saying if you give me your watch, I'll give you $10, I could say if I give you $10, then you give me your watch. Now, obviously, I've just expressed exactly the same social exchange to you. But for logic, it depends what P, it matters what P is and what Q is. Okay? So it matters whether I put the watch in the P, in the antecedent category. Or the, okay, you got it. Okay, I see all these people. Okay, let me move on. All right, so if I put the rule in this form, so if, instead of saying if man has cassava root, eats cassava root that he has a tattoo on his face, then if I say instead if man has a tattoo on his face that he eats cassava root, then you still, if you're looking for cheaters, want to pick the benefit accepted in the cost not paid card.
You're slightly over the... Okay.
The benefit accepted in the cost not paid card. But now those correspond to the logical categories Q and not P, which is not a logically correct response. That's a logically incorrect response. Okay. So this is the percent of people who chose Q and not P on the same problems, descriptive and social contract, like I described before, with the switched, these switched forms. This is a social contract problems. People are picking Q and not P. and they don't pick it, basically. I mean, they basically, you know, either nobody picks it or one person, they don't pick it on the descriptive rules at all. People just don't, this is a very unusual response to pick on a task like this.
In fact, nobody had ever observed this, those card selections before in a way since election passed, let alone predicted that you could manipulate them and bring them into existence.
Right, right, okay. Now, you can actually do the same thing about the logic thing in a completely different way with perspective change. Remember, that has a design feature too, because what counts as cheating should depend on your perspective. Gert Gigerenzer, a colleague of ours, did this. He gave people problems like this. A rule would be, for example, if an employee gets a pension, then he must have worked for the firm for over 10 years. And then you're asked to look for violations, but what differs is one group of subjects is told you are the employer, and others told you are the employee. Right? Now, if you're the employer, you might reasonably think that what counts as cheating is somebody who got the pension but worked less than 10 years, which happens to be P and not Q. If you're an employee, you might think cheating is when somebody didn't get their pension but they worked more than 10 years, right? And so you expect, on the one you expect P and not Q, and the other one you expect not P and Q. And so that's actually exactly what you get. This is the percentage of people who pick P and not Q on the employer one. This is employer, and this is lots of people pick, on the employer, lots of people pick P and not Q. Hardly anybody picks not P and Q, and the opposite is and the opposite is true on the employee one, right? Okay, so that's another way. There you're using exactly the same rule. You're not switching it or anything. You're just switching the perspective. And that also tests for a design feature about perspective change. Now, Vera Malkovich did an interesting thing. One of the things on the reasoning instinct thing was different from more general abilities to reason intelligently and so forth. And what Vera Malkovich did is she looked at people with schizophrenia. And people with schizophrenia, they have lots of deficits in general abilities to reason. So you give them all kinds of reasoning problems, analogical reasoning, all sorts of reasoning problems. They do poorly relative to people who are not schizophrenic. But you thought, well, maybe social contract reasoning, if you're not doing it using the same kinds of general intelligence circuits, it could be preserved, and it could be more ancient, actually, more ancient part of the mind. And just to summarize, basically what she found was that while the schizophrenics were poor at general reasoning compared to the controls, they were identical to the controls on their social contract reasoning, and that was kind of interesting. Now, forget about the logic for a minute. You could say, okay, what if you have some sort of circuits that have to do with that are content dependent, but it's not the social exchange stuff. It has to do with permissions in general. Like they have the general form: if the action is to be taken, then the precondition must be satisfied. To put this into programming terms, what you'd be saying here is that the representation is different in this case. It's not about benefits. It's about actions taken and preconditions satisfied. I mean, it's similar in some ways, more similar than the logic hypothesis, but Cheng and Holyoke could put forth this notion that you have permission schemas. Well, you could say, well, maybe it's not the social contract stuff. Maybe you have a permission schema. It's a little more general than social contract things, but it's less general than logic circuits, okay? Well, notice the one thing about, and they propose that it consists of these four production rules, okay? Notice that there's nothing in here about cheating versus innocent mistakes. Now, what you can do, one way that you can test this hypothesis, actually the perspective, there's nothing in here about perspective either, so actually the perspective change stuff did test against this hypothesis. But anyway, let's say that it didn't exist. One thing that you could do is you can give a person a problem social contract rule in both cases, but in one case, the person who's violated has cheated, and the other case, they've made an innocent mistake where they do not benefit themselves by violating it. So you give a rule like, if a person's to be assigned to Grover High School, then that person must live in Grover City. You tell people Grover High School is a really good high school, gets you to college and all that sort of thing. Living in Grover City has high taxes. Town of Hanover has low taxes. There's volunteers at the Board of Education who are supposed to be sorting students' documents according to this rule. And you find out that some of these people who volunteered are the mothers of high school-aged children. And so you want to find out if any of them have cheated. Okay. The control condition, you say the person sorting these documents at the local school is a little old lady, she's getting a little absent-minded, and you're afraid she may have made some mistakes. Now notice in this innocent mistake condition, the little old lady, she doesn't benefit by violating the rule. There's nothing to benefit her by violating the rule. And so you can ask, but everything else is the same.
So people do benefit.
There are people who benefit, but it's not the person who's violated the rule. Now, the notice in both cases is the social contract, and also in both cases a permission rule. All social contracts are permission rules, but not all permission rules are social contracts. This was done here at UCSB. In the cheating condition, 68% of people got it right. In the innocent mistake condition, it drops to 27%. So you get this, the effect just goes away. It turns out that you need to have a benefit. If you had a permission schema of the kind that I was just showing you, it shouldn't matter whether you have a benefit, whether the action to be taken is a benefit or not. And so we get problems like, this is again in a fictitious culture, one is, if a person's going, for teenagers, if you go out at night, then you have to wear a small piece of volcanic rock around your ankle. Some of these things get strange, because you want them to be sort of unfamiliar. Well, for college students, rather, going out at night is sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's fun. They interpret that as a benefit. And you can compare that to exactly the same situation, only you say the rule is if you stay home at night, then you have to tie a small piece of volcanic rock around your ankle. And then the third condition, we say if you take out the garbage at night, then you have to tie a small piece of volcanic rock around your ankle. In other words, they're all permission rules. They're all the same conditions under which you can take an action. Right? But what you've done is you're taking away the benefit. And when you take away the benefit, you take away the effect. This is two different experiments testing. This is the one I just described to you. This is another experiment testing the same idea. So it matters whether there's a benefit involved. I'm running low on time, so let me just tell you that we did this also in a Hunter Holder Culturalist group in the Ecuadorian Amazon. We have a field site there, and we have graduate students that go down there, and while graduate students in anthropology, and while they're during their downtime, they run psychology experiments, because it's usually not reasonable for, you know, one psychology experiment to go learn an obscure Amazonian language. And
a different way of putting it is that a prediction that these things are evolved parts of species-typical universal human circuitry, and therefore prediction is you ought to be able to find the same odd patterns of reasoning in other cultures, rather than the usual perspective of using anthropology to document what's different. Here you're using different places to triangulate on what's universal computational design. So it's a sort of inversion, it's inverse
right.
Anthropology.
Well, let me just say...
Why I'm not so popular among anthropologists.
Yeah. Well, let me just, because there's something else I want to show you that's more fun. Well, this is fun too, but let me just say that, yes, people in the middle, and our horticulturalists in the middle of the world places, the Ecuadorian Amazon, they're good at detecting cheaters too. This is a reasoning problem they do very well on. Not a problem. Okay. One of the most fun things is... it's fun to me. I don't know if it's fun for you. But there's a... Okay, all social contracts are permission rules, but not all permission rules are social contracts. And there are permission rules like the ones I just told you about where you don't get any effect, right? Now, there is another category of rules. There's actually two other categories of rules so far, threats and precautions, where you get these striking kinds of reasoning effects.
These are other evolutionary domains in which we believe there's independent circuits with a fundamentally different structure.
Right. So a precaution rule might, if you're in a hazardous situation, then you should take the precaution. Low. If you're going to go running into a burning building, then put on the asbestos suit or something, you know, a rule like that. A rule where you want to take a precaution to avoid danger. And you can ask, well, is reasoning, since both of these are permission rules, you can ask, is reasoning about social contracts and permission rules, and precaution rules, rather, generated by one permission schema of the kind that Ching and Holyoke suggested, or by two separate domain-specific mechanisms? Now, there's a lot of ways of testing this. We've done it with normal people with priming studies, and it's too complicated to explain briefly. But the more fun one was Valerie Stone.
But it supports us. Take our word for it.
Valerie Stone looked at a guy who has a patient, RM, who has focal brain damage. And what she found was, even though these rules are, you know, they're all permission rules, right? She found that he reasons normally on precaution rules. He's good at detecting violations of precaution rules. So if you say, if you're taking something hot out of the oven and use an oven mitt, you know, he'll pick the, took the thing out of the oven, did not wear the oven mitt card, right? These are all ways in selection tasks. But he has difficulty detecting cheaters on social exchanges. So here's these are normal controls. These are UCSB undergraduates on the same sets of problems on on precaution rules and social contracts. And here's this guy. Now he's got a hole in his head, right? And here he's at the same place with as the UCSB controls with the precaution rules, but he has this whopping huge deficit on the social contracts. Another way of showing the same data is this is showing, so this is the difference between him and the undergraduates on precaution rules. Basically, there's zero difference between them, and this is the difference on the social contracts. And I was looking at the neuropsych literature, and I was looking at kind of the sizes of effects that people get excited about. And frequently, they're excited about 10 percentage point differences.
So, when you throw these things, what are the error
bars? This is percent correct.
No, what was the size of the sample?
Oh, and with the... With the UCSB students, with him, it's one. He's a guy. All right. But the UCSB students, it's about 37 students, and we did all the statistics. I wouldn't tell you, if it wasn't statistically significant, I would not tell you the effects, because that would not be interesting.
A clinical psychiatrist,
they say this person has had a motorcycle accident, something about
his brain. They would talk about his brain. Well, they don't know it.
A clinical
neuropsychologist wouldn't know about this.
We had to design the battery of tests and administer it to somebody who had damage in a certain part of his brain.
What was the worst single UCSB student?
There was nobody who had a discrepancy of his size between these two rules. Nobody. You can get things wrong for lots of reasons. You don't actually have to be brain damaged to get something wrong.
We have subject.
We consistently, if you notice, and none of these problems are 100% of people getting them correct, but it's not the same individuals usually. We also have some other problems. Have a discrepancy like this in any of the other subjects.
And yet, there's still some ways of handling it, even if there were, because unlike inanimate systems, humans are ornery, and so you get subjects and they come in. And they just sort of, they don't care. They want to be out of there. They just sort of fill out anything. And so you'll get, occasionally get things. But we didn't have to, in this study, we didn't have to worry about issues like that. But there are objective ways of dealing with orneriness.
This is what's called as a dissociation. You know, in other words, if it was a single permission schema that was generating performance in both domains, then this guy should be impaired in both cases. But you should only be able to get a dissociation like this if there's two different mechanisms involved, and one's been impaired and one hasn't been impaired in them. Also, nobody said that normal controls don't have brain damage.
And with this,
I'm actually not saying that to be snarky. I'm saying that people fall on their heads. A lot of times, journalists will find this out. They go, they'll be doing a story like on MRIs or something like that, functional imaging of the brain, and they'll, for dramatic purposes, will have themselves put into the MRI machine, and it'll turn out there's a big hole in part of the brain that nobody ever knew about, and it doesn't seem to impair them very much, at least not that anybody has noticed.
It may be that they'd be very poor at picking out habitats as hunter-gatherers, but that's
nobody's testing that. To answer Tony's question, that's exactly the thing, is that until you do these sorts of things, most people who do neuropsychology are interested in much grosser questions like, is the person's language function intact or not? They're not interested. They'll notice things like the person's social behavior may be very odd, but it's very hard to get precise about what you mean by odd social behavior. But some of these things provide ways of getting more precise about what you mean by odd social behavior, or at least odd social thinking. Yeah. Anyway, I've been showing you like little pieces of the data that we've collected. There's more, but just to give you an overview.
One thing to say is you've seen a few experimental texts, and I want to say it doesn't rest on any one of these things. There are now, you know, on the rough order of, you know, maybe 150 different problems maybe that have been tried.
Done in lots of labs.
It's done all around the world now.
So when you want to show that something's an adaptation, that something is designed by natural selection, you want to show evidence of special design. It's much the same as if you were an archaeologist. Let's say you were an archaeologist from the future. You're coming back to the to what year is it, 1998, and you're having an argument with one of your colleagues about an artifact, two artifacts that you found, or an artifact that you found. And your colleague is saying it's a stove, and you're saying it's a television set. How would you settle this argument? You would settle it by design evidence, right? So if the one person pointed out, well, look, it doesn't do much to heat up anything, but on the other hand, it can transduce electromagnetic radiation into a bitmap, you know, that would be an argument from special design. You're showing that there's lots of design features that are well designed for solving a problem of the TV solve, and there's not very much design there that would be good at cooking food. And so again, when you're looking at machines in the head, it's the same kind of you're looking for design evidence. So what we found so far is that the algorithms that govern reasoning about social contracts have a lot of properties. First of all, they operate even in unfamiliar situations. The definition of cheating that they embody depends on your perspective. They're just as good at computing the cost-benefit representation of a social contract from the perspective of one party as from the perspective of another. I didn't really talk about that, but it's true. They embody implicational procedures specified by our task analysis. That's getting at this not P and Q versus P and not Q stuff, but they include inference procedures that seem to be specialized for cheater detection. The cheater detection procedures cannot detect violations of social contracts when those violations do not correspond to cheating, so like the innocent mistake sort of thing. It's looking like they don't include altruist detection procedures. So if you give the same problems and you ask people to look for altruists instead of looking for cheaters, they don't do very well. And they cannot operate so as to detect cheaters unless the rule has been assigned the cost-benefit representation of a social contract. By the same token, a number of byproduct hypotheses have been empirically eliminated. So whenever you want to show that something is an adaptation, you also have to show that it's not, that what you've been studying is not just a byproduct of some other mechanism or of a more general mechanism and so forth. Right? So first of all, one byproduct hypothesis was about familiarity. It's been, everybody agrees that familiarity can't explain this kind of effect. Second thing is, it's not the case that social contract content merely facilitates the application of rules of inference of the propositional calculus. It does not merely afford clear thinking. It's not that when you're given a social contract that you just can think clearer about it. The innocent mistake condition is one condition that shows that, for example. Permission schema theory, the one that I showed you before, of that little set of production rules, that can't explain the social contract effect. And it's not the case that any problem involving payoffs will elicit the detection of violations. So basically, what we've been trying to do, well, you want to sum up or do?
I think it's, we don't need to sum up.
The kind of research program that we've been pursuing is for different kinds of adaptive problems. Social contracts are one, threats are another one, precaution rules we've been looking at, coalitional thinking, the way that people think about groups.
In-group, out-group
kinds of thinking. These are the sorts of...
The special game theory problems, which are very specific to coalitions.
Statistical, we've been looking at statistical reasoning. There have been claims that humans are very bad at statistical reasoning, probabilistic reasoning, yet then there were these other studies from behavioral ecology about bumblebees that follow Bayes' rule. And so you're wondering, how can it be that
the standard view of cognitive psychology was that human statistical reasoning was, we didn't have any...
That we were stupid.
And that we were riddled with fallacies and biases. And you can still buy books on about how bad people are at this. And it turns out that it's an artifact of how you give the information. If you give the information in the ways that people would have experienced it or encountered it as hunter-gatherers, people are extremely good.
Right.
Okay. If you give it in culturally unusual modern fashion, for example, a single event
probabilities instead of a frequency.
A probability of a single event is unobservable. Okay. And so therefore it's not the kind of information that you could have taken as an input as a hunter-gatherer, whereas frequentist databases are something that was how you've done it. Then it turns out that these mechanisms turn on and they give extremely well calibrated responses.
Right. If you were looking for a program in your calculator, you know, you wouldn't give it, and if your calculator was if you're giving it on the normal adding pad numbers in base 10, you wouldn't give it something, you wouldn't give it 10 plus 10 and then think to yourself, I really mean it's base 2, you know, and then say, oh, it's wrong because it gave 20 instead of, you know. That's the kind of thing that you have to give, the information in the format that the mechanism is designed to take. And when you do that with statistical reasoning, you find that untutored people, you know, do well on that too. So yeah, I basically say that we're stopped and we'll take questions now. Oh yeah. Yeah. How you should teach it. Yes.
Right.
Yes. In fact,
some people have a lot of trouble learning string theory.
Yeah. I can't tell you how best to teach string theory. There may not be a best way to teach string, but yeah, no. In fact, I have a paper on my desk at home that I'm supposed to review that's about that exactly. I mean, yes. If you want to teach statistical reasoning, probabilistic reasoning, do it in frequencies, and not only do it in frequencies, but Don't even do it in relative frequencies. I don't know if you want those, but yes, you can make it simple for people, or you can just make them miserable. And it's even worse. Actually, it's even worse in life because there's all these different schools of probability theory, and in a lot of statistics books, at least the ones that are given to people in psychology and so forth, they're all mushed together as if they're the same. So in psychology, we're shown the pretty signal detection curves, you know, Neyman-Pearson decision theory, you know, and then there's two kinds of errors and blah, 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 blah. Right. Then you're taught Fisherian analysis of variance. And you're going, what happened to the other error? Where's the other kind of error? And that's because there isn't another kind of error in this other school.
It's really a scandal.
Right. Oh, all of this, right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So present directed and former directed.
It's very plausible. The place that it seems to me weakest is in really showing, in particular, that the social contract isn't just something that is natural, but is common to human beings. Because I watch my kids and my grandchildren developing and practicing with social contracts with their parents all the time. And how do you really make sure? And there was one item on one of your last lists that I thought was approaching that. And you said that you had been actually able to show that the familiarity wasn't just making it easier to operate on the logical circuits.
Right. Well, they're not logical circuits. Also, the other thing is that they're not logical circuits because people are quite happy.
You call them circuits.
They're social contract circuits. They're,
in the book that I read on this, it was called G.
It was called G? Oh, that's a totally different school of thought. When people talk about G in quotes, they're talking about
general intelligence.
General intelligence.
Oh, gene for.
Oh, the gene. Oh, I thought you were saying. I'm sorry. I thought you were saying the letter G. Never mind.
No.
Yeah.
The altruism gene.
I'm sorry. I misheard. The familiar. There's a lot of experiments that show that it's not familiarity. One is that you can give people unfamiliar materials, and the same thing happens.
The social contract.
One of the things that's interesting about it is that there's
Let's just say, I mean, yes, the general question is how do we know that this has anything to do with evolution at all? Okay. And what about just learning? Okay. And
which is another way of putting that question. Is were these, even if these are domain-specific social contract algorithms, were they built by a domain general learning process? Is a way of putting your question. And so now each alternative theory does posit a different evolved machinery and makes different kinds of predictions.
Let me just highlight a point here which may go by so fast, but is really the key point, which is that people treat learning as if it's a well-known, well-documented mechanistic explanation for how things come about. Okay. And in fact, it is nothing of the kind. Learning is a folk psychological concept which says that something about being in this environment leads to the acquisition of knowledge. Okay. Then you want to get more formal about it. You want to say, what are the circuits? What's the formal structure of the algorithms that allow learning to take place? Okay. And as soon as you form that question, then you start to discover that, in fact, most of the notions that there's a general algorithm which learns lots of stuff easily and well, is nobody's been able to produce such a thing. Okay. And you have to start to get formal about what's the exact structure of the procedure which allows acquisition. And as soon as you then put competitive models of what those procedures look like, then you can start to test those hypotheses specifically. Can a connectionist net learn the past tense or something? Those are answerable kinds of questions.
The language people do this very nicely. There's a field of linguistics called learnability theory,
right,
where they take different learning theories and they say, given the information a child's exposed to, could it in principle, with this learning algorithm, learn, say, the past tense? To give you a more schematic answer here, domain general processes are by definition content-free. That's how they're defined here. And so they get all of the content from the environment experienced by individual organisms. So for one thing, the content of the scheme is built, and the kind of scheme is built should reflect the statistical distribution of problems found in a given modern society. So to take an example of phobias, if you were arguing of the same question with phobias, the domain general person should say, well, you should have phobias to things that are dangerous in the modern environment, like, you know, light sockets and cars and things like that. The person arguing on the other side might say, no, you'll develop most easily phobias to ancestral dangers like spiders and snakes and so forth. And it turns out that's true. And that when you ask Chicago school children what they're to be afraid of, they say wild animals. They're in the middle of Chicago, right?
Most dangerous things in Hyde Park or not. This is Hyde Park. Specifically we're talking about. Okay.
Secondly, it should not reflect necessarily the distribution of problems found under ancestral conditions. So, for example, I think that if it were domain general content-free mechanisms, then there ought to be permission schemas of the kind that Chang and Holyoke proposed, because permissions are, by definition, more common than social contracts. So why wouldn't an inductive mechanism simply generalize up to this more general level? And especially given like the bureaucratic world we live in that's full of permission rules and nobody can even understand what they're for or what they mean.
And logical falsification is even more common, yeah. Okay.
Right.
And yet people can't do that.
Other currently important domains. Uh-huh. So troubleshooting and fixing appliances should yield schemas that are good at detecting violations of causal rules. But people don't. We've tested causal rules, and people aren't good at looking for violations of causal rules. You should see more variation across cultures with social contract algorithms developing in some but not others. I mean, we can't speak for all cultures, but all the ones that have been tested, we find the same thing happening. And then you also need to explain, there's recent data suggesting precocious emergence of this, that three-year-olds are not so bad at doing this cheater detection sort of thing. And because you've got to ask the question, why do you find precocious emergence of these things? You don't need precocious emergence, but... An evolved adaptation...
The way you mature, so things come online, mechanisms come online at different points in life. And so,
right,
for example, you're not born with teeth.
Right.
You're not. Women aren't born with breasts. They develop in different parts. So anything can come online at any point in the life cycle. But if the claim is that it's a general learning thing, exposed to a general environment, then that predicts that all things of certain difficulty should be acquired about the same time.
Yeah, depending on how you're exposed to them.
Whereas if you get something of a particular evolutionary significance that matures very early, and something else like calculus that takes a long, or even arithmetic or something, that's inherently not much more difficult for arithmetic.
But you find things like the preschoolers appear to be pretty good at detecting cheaters, yet they think that the word needle is sharp. They think that if you pour water from a long, tall thing into a short, wide thing, that's not the same amount of water. They think that there are more daisies than flowers. And they think all kinds of sort of strange things that are from there. And so these are the kinds of questions you'd want to ask. You'd want to look for data that spoke to these two questions. It's the more general answer to your question.
Did Paul have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to know, you said that Bayesian distance is more natural?
No. No. No, no, no. What I said was
more natural in the sense of
No. No. No.
You said that bumblebee foraging follows Bayes' rule.
I said that bumblebees forage in ways that obey the constraints of Bayes' rule.
Okay, so
which Bayes' rule can be applied either to frequencies or to probabilities of single events.
But other problems might require other statistical models.
Right.
Okay, I'm interested in the biological applications of something that Bayes' rule is something that's okay. So, I mean, how probably
that's not how I would put it. No. In fact, people aren't so hot at relative frequency. If you want to know, this is what they're... Okay, you can give them a Bayesian reasoning problem, and you can give it to them in frequency format. So let me give you an example of two different ways of... a non-frequency... Here's a simple version of a non-frequency format. if a test to detect a disease whose prevalence is 1 in 1,000 has a false positive rate of 5%, what's the chance that a person found to have a positive result actually has the disease, assuming that you know nothing about the person's symptoms or signs? This was given to Harvard Medical School fourth year medical students and staff.
The people who are, if you're lucky, you would have diagnosed you.
Yeah. And only 18% of them got it right.
Okay.
And if you give it to Stanford undergraduates, 12% of them get it right.
So now, that's the value. A Harvard education is 6%. Or if we'd actually shown you on the social contract reasoning between should be our hunter horticulturalists and Harvard undergraduates, you would have seen that there was only a very tiny increment, which was the value of a Harvard education.
On the real cards. Okay, now you can say, well, maybe they don't understand now. It's a frightening thing to think your physician doesn't know what a false positive is, right? Okay, but you can say maybe they don't understand. And so you can make it clearer. You can make the single event version. See, knows the single event and says, what's the chance that a person found to have, you know, a positive result actually has a disease? And you're putting everything in terms of relative frequencies like 5% here. But you've made it clearer, like saying, well, you don't use the term false positive. You say every time, you know, sometimes a person comes out positive when it's given to a person who's completely healthy, specifically 5%. Then you help people a little bit up to 36%, but that's, you know. On the other hand, if you do an infrequency, so you say 1 out of every 1,000 Americans has disease X, there's been this test, but sometimes the test also comes out positive when it's given to a person who's completely healthy, specifically out of every 1,000 people who are perfectly healthy, 50 of them test positive for disease. And then you say, how many people who test positive for the disease, notice it's how many people who test positive for disease will actually have the disease, blank out of blank. Then, you know, 76% of the same undergraduates where 12% got wrong, 76% of these know that the answer is 1 out of 51. Right, because you've got 1,000 people. Okay, and if you make it even more ecologically valid by putting, if you make it even more sort of visual by saying, giving the same sort of problem, but you give them squares, each one represents the person, you say circle the ones that actually have the disease and the ones that test positive, 92% of people get it right and so forth. But here's
and
the way.
And here we're talking about exactly right.
Yes, it's exactly right. I don't mean like in the neighborhood. But this is really how people think about, this is really how people think about this stuff. This is the most natural way to think about it. You can think about adaptations as being designed for certain kinds of sampling schemes, too.
Rita?
Yeah.
I'm not sure we ought to give a whole other lecture on okay, this is okay? Okay.
Well, so in the real world, it's almost never the case if you're a hunter-gatherer that somebody says, okay, there's 10 apple trees and there's 10 cherry trees and the proportion of red fruit on each one is this and this. It's not the way the world works. What really happens is you're walking through the forest, right, and you're encountering things. And if you're encountering things, you don't need to know the base rate because it's embodied in your actual experience of the world, right? Because the results in this experience with people not doing well with base rates. So really what you have, you 36 trees, 12 apple trees, 24 other trees, say. And let's say you want to know, you know, given that I see red fruit, what's the probability it's an apple tree? Well, if you're just counting up hits and false alarms, you know, fruit, apple trees with red fruit and non-apple trees with red fruit, it's trivial, right? It's the number of hits divided by the number of hits plus the number of false alarms. Now, to do this, you have to keep the data in the format of absolute frequencies, not relative frequencies. And this seems to be the way that our minds most naturally reason about these problems. And so if you wanted to design something that was, you know, that's how I would do it.
There's a question from the front.
Yeah. Most of the things
can you speak a little bit louder?
Social contract, etc., you could potentially learn in your development phase. But anything that you could expect a hunter-gatherer, any skill that a hunter-gatherer would have that is lost in modern society, that people can't see if people are genetically better at that.
Can you repeat the question, perhaps?
Let's see if I understand it correctly. The question is, social contracts are something that would be useful for people everywhere. So if you have an alternative view that we're not really worried about how things get learned or what the formal procedures are, you'd still expect the incidence for it to be anywhere, okay, to be everywhere. But are there things which are not useful for us in many, for people in many cultures, which are useful for hunter-gatherers and yet which nevertheless we display facility with? Is that the question?
Yes. Okay. Spiders, phobias, snake phobias.
More than that, we just did a recent study on exactly this approach. The interest is do people reason about the mental states of predators and prey better than they reason about other animals, okay? And
or the same animals when they're not in a predator-prey context.
Or the same animals when they're not in a predator-prey context. And we're working with Clark Barrett on this. And it's very interesting and very weird stuff, because you take this general, the whole design of it is this sort of cultural dissociation design. That is, we have this field site where people hunt all the time, and very, you know, three-year-olds are busy dismembering animals, and they're sort of, you know, everybody has a direct experience that people bring home as pets, you know, offspring of prey animals have been killed, and children will play with them and so on. So there's a lot of predator-prey interaction by even small children, okay? On the other hand, in our culture, there's very little of that, okay? And more than that, there's a whole set of information that you get, okay? So we did the contrasting study in a Montessori school in Ojai, okay? And in there they have Elmo, and they have all sorts of cartoon animals and Muppets, okay? And you have you know, lions sleeping with lambs, and you have all sorts of things which are wildly against normal predator-prey reactions. If you watch cartoons in the morning, one thing is that children are intensely interested. Many of them have a predator-prey theme. And one thing that's accurate about the predator and prey theme is, of course, the chasing element, okay? But one thing that's highly inaccurate is that the prey animal gets the upper hand, that nobody's ever
Tweety
killed.
Tweety bird, Sylvester the cat.
Right, okay. Nobody's ever killed. If an animal is damaged, they spring back the next time. Okay, you have lots of quite palpably false information. And in fact, if you look at the socialization of young children does not involve giving them true information. Most of what you give children is, in fact, wildly false information. Okay, and this is what we consider being nice to children. Okay, and yet, children. And I actually, I think there's some actual complexities about that, which I think are extremely interesting. But I don't think we should be like the villains in various children's things about take away pretense from children. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, observe the fact that children are amazingly resilient. Okay, when we ask children
What happens when the lion sees a zebra?
The lion and zebra meet. What happens next? Okay, they say the lion chases the zebra, the lion catches the zebra, the lion eats the zebra's just bones, the zebra's dead, the zebra... Okay, we had a whole bunch of much more complicated inference questions like, you know, the zebra eats grass, the grass stays short because the zebra is eating it every day. Okay, because you hear lots of child psychologists say children don't understand what death is, okay?
And until they're 10.
Until they're 10, okay? And this seems extremely improbable to us. And however, ways people learn to speak about death when they're talking about humans are extremely complicated, and even adults say what happened, you know.
Where's grandma? She's with Jesus now.
Okay, right. She's enjoying everlasting bliss, okay? She's got whatever, okay? It takes, adults have trouble sorting out all this stuff. Children may well have trouble sorting this stuff out. So if you move the context away from humans to animals, okay, then despite the fact that they're bombarded by incredible amounts of false information, they don't, it was like no kid said, oh, you know, the zebra came back, or the zebra is happy, or the zebra, the zebra is never coming back. The grass is going to go along in the meadow where the zebra was, because the zebra is never going to be there, okay? Even
weirder is with adults. We did a thing with adults that was really strange, which is we just asked people to rate how reasonable different sentences were from 0 to 10, you know, and 10 being the most reasonable. And so they're getting them in all kinds of orders and so forth, and they're just supposed to give their gut reaction to each one. And so some of them are real straightforward, like the lion saw the zebra, but at another point they might be seeing. So they might say, "With the lion saw the zebra, give it a 9." That's a reasonable version.
Can we get the background? Okay. The background is that we had talked earlier about there's something called the theory of mind mechanism, which is that people automatically compute the mental states and representations of other people. If you're looking at this, you know about it, or that you're looking at the candy, that's the one you're going to want, or something like that. But people, the proper domain of this is other humans, okay? And people tend to resist making certain kinds of claims about animal minds. Okay?
If you ask them explicitly, do animals decide, do they think, et cetera, they'll say no.
They'll say no, they won't. Okay, right. So their explicit cultural representations.
If you think about how what you need to be able to do in order to hunt, or what you need to be able to do in order to avoid being, you know, a lion lunch, right? You need to be able to predict behavior on a really short time scale. So you need to make some of the same inferences about seeing leads to knowing.
You need to make a subset of these inferences. There's the computational primitives you come up with that you can't explain predator-prey interactions unless you say that the reason why the zebra is not running away is the zebra hasn't seen the lion yet.
Yep.
Oh, now the zebra is running. That's because the zebra saw and knows the lion is there. Okay. So you have to use a certain subset of theory of mind primitives, computational units, in order to have an economical inference engine that will account for the behavior of predator-prey interactions,
right.
Okay? And so the question is, is this thing there intact in young children, immune from this bombardment of falsehood? And also, is it present in adults, even when they explicitly have representations to the contrary? Animals don't think. Animals don't know things.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so when you ask them, you know, how reasonable these things are, if it says the lion saw the zebra, they'll give that a 9. If it says the lion saw the other lion, they'll give that a 7.
Mm-hmm.
If you say the zebra knew that the lion had seen it, they might give that, you know, a 6. If you said the zebra knew that the other zebra had seen it, they might give that a 3. Now, this is
so
weird.
So if you move it into part of
this
context,
really
they find mental state attributions reasonable. And if you move them out of the theory of mind, if you move them out of the predator prey context, they no longer find the same representations reasonable.
Even with seeing, for God's sakes, nobody would deny. If you ask them explicitly, can a lion see another lion? Everybody would say, of course, they can see objects, they can see other lions, they can see grass, they can see all these things. I mean, it's like bizarro. But you just ask them for their gut reaction, and the reason we did this was because our notion was that you're designed to think about the mental states of animals in predator-prey context. That when it's a non-predator-prey context, we're not particularly designed to be thinking about the natural history in general, like about lions mating with other lions or other sorts of things. That as hunter-gatherers, we're concerned with lions as predators, and we're concerned with ourselves as predators on other animals. And so it was...
Tom has a question. You gave this example of the brain damage patient where a certain one of these circuits seems to be localized in particular places in the brain. Is there evidence that all of these are localized?
What you'd expect is that circuits need to be connected to each other, and that a circuit that's computing one kind of thing may need to produce information or access information somewhere else, so that while some things may be localized, other things you would expect to be
physically distributed,
but that doesn't mean murkily everything does everything. It means that they'll interpenetrate each other. Okay, and that means, and since damage happens without regard to
function
computational boundaries, you frequently get a bunch of stuff that go out at once. So localization is always a matter of messy degree.
We don't necessarily expect everything to be localized.
But for
our purposes, it's convenient.
To the extent that
it is localized,
then that allows brain damage to tell you things about the organization. So, for example, the fact that brain damage can cause a dissociation between precautions and social exchanges shows that those are being computed to some extent independently. And then the account, it's possible to come up with a learning account for that, but it's more difficult. It says there's something privileged about that distinction, which manifests itself in a physical way that's different than all the other infinite number of ways you could divide up the same data
carve
set.
Up, and carve up the world, right.
Okay. Well, because of the IPP picnic, the rest of the few stuff we should wrap it up. So, thank you again.